Okay, apologies already. Holy cow, I thought I had set it up correctly to play a different opening song. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to start the show over. Just hang on a second, and the show is going to start now. Maybe.
There you go.
Much better.
Yeah, there you go.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Miles Davis. Okay, that was just a little bit of Miles. I played Miles in honor of our esteemed guest here on the TFT radio show. I have for you Jersey Jazzman. I believe this is the most highly anticipated TFT radio show ever, given the number of people in the chat room.
That is crazy. That's crazy, but thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. And thank you for playing some Miles at the beginning, too. Kind of Blue, 1959 or 1961? I can't remember. Somebody's going to correct me. And the piece is All Blues. That's one of my all-time favorite albums, so thank you. That's really cool.
Did I get that right?
You totally nailed it. If you had played Duke Ellington, it would have been right up there, right next to it. But that Kind of Blue, if you're not sure that you're into jazz, that's the album to get. Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, listen to it, and then you can sort of decide whether or not jazz is going to be your thing. So that album is a touchstone for me. Isn't that nice of you? Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. So, Jersey, let me welcome you formally.
Thank you.
We've been trying to put this together now for, I don't know, a few months, I think.
It's been a while, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was saying to you before we got started, and I want to make sure that everybody hears this, that it is just so great what you're doing, and there is such a value in someone like you who's out on the West Coast talking to somebody like me from Jersey, and all of us sort of realizing that we are not fighting this on our own. We're not in this battle all by ourselves, you know, thinking that we're howling against the wind. There is a huge value in hearing just another person talking about the same thing, coming from the same place. You know, the deck is so stacked against us right now.
Right.
And Diane Ravitch, God bless her, I think she puts it really, really well. They have all the money, they have all the power, but we have the numbers. And we have to do things to remind ourselves that we have the numbers. So that was one of the reasons why I was so thrilled to do this with you, is what you're doing is so important, and I really appreciate it. And I know there are a lot of other people out there who appreciate it too. Even if, you know, I can't get in and listen live every time, I go back and I listen to the archives, and it really does matter. We have to take advantage of these ways of communicating with each other that technology affords us. And again, just to remind ourselves that there are other people out there who feel the same way. So thank you. I appreciate it, T.
Well, it's my pleasure. Like I say, this is highly anticipated. There's a bunch of people in the chat room, and anybody listening is free to call in and talk with us. So,
yeah, please do.
So let's go ahead and get started. I don't necessarily have a plan, but one of the things I wrote in the little blurb there on the...
You know what? It's all jazz, so there doesn't have to be a plan. We're going to improvise, you know? That's what it's about.
Teaching is jazz. Teaching
isn't it,
is an art.
Isn't it? You know what? I have said that to so many people, and I know you're a musician, and I know you love music, and
yeah.
I can tell that from the things that you play and the bumper music. There is something to this idea that we're creating this art, but it's got enough freedom in it that we're reacting to what's going on. And to me, it's one of the reasons that I fell in love with teaching. It was such an analogy between that and playing jazz, where you have a framework, you have a common idea of where you're going, but you're also open to seeing what happens, what reaction you're going to have with other musicians, what reaction you're going to have with the audience. And, you know, it's one of the things that I think people in the profession get, but I wonder if others do not. And sometimes there's this notion that we always have to be completely scripted and completely perfect. But even a classical musician will tell you that you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
Even if every note is written down, you're still not sure how things are going to unfold. And with jazz, that freedom is, you know, it's
well,
let me
ask you a jazz question. A hack musician like me, you know, I took piano lessons when I was a kid, and I taught myself how to play rock and roll guitar at summer camp. You know, I'm just a hack. But
I don't believe that, but go ahead.
All right, well, I am. But a real musician like you, I assume, like Miles, you know, real musicians, you cannot play jazz unless you are indeed a well-schooled musician. I mean, you can't play jazz if you can't read music, can you?
No. Well, first of all, don't ever put me and Miles in the same sentence, because you know that. Because obviously that is like me and going out and taking my 3-mile run every day being compared to Frank Shorter. You know, obviously we're at completely different levels.
Okay.
But yeah, that's actually one of the myths about jazz, and I think it's safe to say one of the myths about teaching too. Yeah, there is not a discipline to it. And it's one of these things that really irks me about TFA. Oh, yeah, we're going to take this smart kid. And nobody is going to say that, you know, the people who pass into TFA aren't, you know, smart people. But we're going to take this smart kid, we'll give him 5 weeks of training, and all of a sudden, you know, he's going to be better because he went to an elite school than somebody who went to some state school or, you know, wherever else and actually went through an internship and student taught and did all this other stuff. That there's some sort of, you know, that the technique of it is really not that important, and what you need is just intelligence and passion and talent. Well, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. And, you know, I can say personally as a jazz musician, I've seen people who are, you know, great classical musicians or whatever else really struggle with playing jazz because you don't have that background and that training within you know, that domain.
Right.
In the same way with teaching, you know, you don't just automatically become a master teacher. I'm not saying that there aren't people who don't have a natural talent for it and find themselves very quickly, and other people take longer. But this notion that somehow, you know, the pedagogy of it, the techniques of teaching, it's something you'll pick up quickly. It's nonsense. And this is something that people within the profession understand. People outside of the profession, who unfortunately, some of whom are getting too much say in our profession right now, there isn't enough acknowledgement of that. There isn't enough acknowledgement of putting in the years and putting in the work and having it pay off.
Well, here's
why do you think,
I mean, I totally agree, the public or the reformers seem to have ideas that we teachers know are insane. We tell them they're insane, yet they're not impressed. Is that because all these people were once kids in school, and by virtue of that alone, they feel that they have an insider's understanding? I mean, is it really just that simple?
That's a really deep question, actually, T. And, you know, I'm not sure that I have a real easy facile answer for that. I think there are several things. Yeah, I think what you're saying is right. We all went to school, so we all think we have an idea about what makes a good teacher and what doesn't. And I'm not invalidating people having that input. I think that's perfectly legitimate.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, if you've flown on a plane, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden you know how to you're somebody who can make a judgment about who should be flying a 747 and who shouldn't, you know.
Right.
So there is that part of it. I do think there is a kind of looking down our nose a little bit at the teaching profession because it's not particularly well paid. You know, it's not held at a high esteem like being a doctor or being an architect or, you know, any number of other professions that you could think of.
The two professions you just mentioned, by the way, are highly paid, which kind of fits in with what I think might be true also, and that is that Americans worship people with money and respect people with money. So teachers and, you know, car mechanics and the gardener don't get a whole lot of respect.
There is no doubt of that. There is you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, I can see so both sides of the response to that, because on the one side you want to say, okay, let's pay teachers more. Hey, I'm all for paying teachers more. Don't get me wrong. But on the other hand, you know, not everything should be about money. You know, and I have enormous respect, and it's appropriate to talk about this on this weekend. I have enormous respect for the people who put on the uniform and serve this country. I have family members, and my wife has family members who have gone out and literally put their lives on the line for this country. Did they make as much as a hedge fund manager? No. Is what the hedge fund manager does more important? Should it be more respected than a guy who laces up his combat boots or a gal who does that and goes out and serves this country? Under no circumstances should that be true. So at some point, you know, we as a society have to say to ourselves, it's got to be more about the money. It's got to be more than just the money. And
right.
Respect is something that doesn't just come from how much you make. It comes from service. It comes from whether you make a difference in people's lives, whether you make this country a better place, whether you make this world a better place. Teachers do that every day. But I do think you're right. You know, sometimes the pay can hold people back. And that was going to kind of bring me my third thing. And this is something I've talked about on the blog, but I've deliberately been careful about this because I don't want it to be misconstrued. Part of it, unquestionably for me, is sexism. And, you know, again, here's two guys talking to each other about teaching. Teaching is a profession where the majority of the people who do it are women.
Right.
And I don't think that people would have as many people would not have the lack of reservation about talking about teachers making lots of money, oh, they get these great benefits, gold-plated benefits, whatever else, if it wasn't true that we were a profession where the majority of the practitioners are women, particularly at the elementary level. I find that to be sort of a subtext that's very subtle, but at the same time, at least for me, it's very clear.
I think you're right. I think Diane actually has been mentioning that lately, and it's sort of under the radar, but given American worship and money worship, of course it's true.
Yeah.
Jersey, we have a caller.
Yeah.
calling in. So area code 516, you are on the air. Tell us who you are and anything else you want to tell us about you.
Okay. My name is Arthur Goldstein. I'm an ESL teacher.
Yeah,
I've been talking to you on Twitter a little bit. I'm the ESL chapter leader at Francis Lewis High School in Queens. And
Hey, Arthur, how are you?
How you doing? I was kind of interested when you guys were talking about improvisation, because I think that, like, maybe like a good musician, I think a good teacher kind of finds his or her own voice after a while in the classroom. I don't think you can just, you know, train for 6 weeks and go in and be a really good teacher. And I think there is an element of improvisation. I teach English to kids, and, I mean, what the kids do really dictates, you know, where I will go and what I will do. And I will, you know, follow where they go and try to let them lead as much as possible. And I think that makes learning English kind of a joyous and interesting thing rather than just, you know, read the book and do the exercise and, you know, do the homework.
Wait, are you suggesting, Arthur? He said in filling in the bubble. I was gonna ask you, Arthur, are you suggesting that allowing kids a bit of an investment in their education might make learning whatever it is a little more, I don't know, worthy of their investment?
Oh, sure, sure. I want them to love what they do. It's an act of seduction, you know. You want them
right.
to love it. You want them to be really in it, and you want their heart in it. And, you know, to make a kid speak English, you are on the radio, you're speaking, you write, as does Jersey Jazzman. You know, we love the language, and it's like my job to make these kids love this language that I love. And, if I have to teach the test, I've done that too, but it's not nearly the same thing as teaching.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, first of all, God bless you. And it's people like you that are really laying the groundwork for the American society. And
well, thanks.
What
that's really kind of you.
No, but it's the truth. And when you hear somebody express it in that way, it's undeniable that this is obviously someone who cares not just about the kids, but about society. That that we have an obligation to make teaching not just about getting the right answer, but getting people to care about learning, to care about, you know, bettering themselves. So God bless you for what you're doing. And second thing, God bless you for teaching in Queens, where you have this insane idea in the New York City schools that it's a good thing to take a bubble test, put it through a statistical model that everyone knows is riddled with errors, there's no doubt about this, and then publish it publicly to say whether or not you are bringing value to your city. It is one of the craziest things that I think I've ever seen in my life.
That's not coming to Jersey? Isn't that Duncan and Obama are pushing that. I'm very surprised that Christie hasn't brought it to Jersey. I would think he would adore it.
He can't wait. He can't wait.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, I'll tell you, Jersey's got some interesting sort of local things, and we could get into that, whatever. The main thing I wanted to say to you is that for somebody who's coming up against all this, to see the larger picture and to see the idea that we are trying to teach to open the kids' minds and to teach the passion, it's not an easy thing to do. So God bless you, man. You know.
Well,
and,
God bless
and
you. Clearly, you're seeing that
keep
too.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
You know, one thing that I think drives all three of us in our practice is the knowledge that we have that, how do I put it, that human brains are built for learning. So it's not our job to create knowledge, which seems to be what a lot of people out there want us to do or expect us to do. We are facilitators of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is excite their brain so that their brain does what it's supposed to do naturally. And so many of our impoverished kids have stifled little brains, and they don't work as well as they could. And then we get blamed for the when these kids don't perform on tests. The whole purpose of schooling and living is for your brain to learn shit. That's what they do. That's all a brain does. It's a pattern-seeking device, for God's sakes. You know what I'm saying?
That's really well put, because it's sort of the idea that, are you going to take this brain and you're going to fill it up with stuff, or are you going to take this brain and you're going to teach a kid how to take care of it and how to love it and how to respect it? And to me, the second is far more important, especially in this world, because we have so much information now. And that's actually one of the things that I get concerned about in this sort of reforming movement, that you're right, and it's well put, that we're filling up their brains with stuff. Their brains are already filled with stuff. There's so
and
much
we're,
stuff
and we're not
there.
Even we're not even filling them up, you know, because they can't. You can't do that. You can't just pour knowledge in. So that's just a misnomer anyway. You know what I you know what I mean? We that's what we're tasked with doing lately, but it's not happening because brains don't work that way. Hang on, everybody. We do have another caller that I'm going to.
Okay, I'm
going to
get off,
on.
Guys. Thank you.
Okay,
hey, thanks,
Arthur.
It's good to hear from you.
Area code, so what is that, an 856? You're on the air.
Hi, Jazzman. It's Rita from Cherry Hill.
Hey, Rita. How are you? I was sitting here thinking to myself, 856, 856. I think that's Jersey. How are you, Rita?
Good. How are you doing? I want to thank you for being such an inspiration to me.
Oh,
Rita,
stop.
Rita, who are you? How do you know Jersey? Why do you love him so much?
He and I know each other because of a situation we have going on in Cherry Hill called Regis, which the Jazzman knows about very well. It's a school that should not have been approved, a charter school that should not have been approved.
Okay.
Rita, you want to tell the story or should I? Yeah, we'll try to keep this short.
The short story of it is, the school that was came through and was approved is a Christian church run by a pastor who is also running a ministry for ex-offenders on the same site where the charter school is going to be held. There are so many things wrong with the approval, from the fact that there was no parent from the sending district along with the two pastors who are running it, and there's no separation between the church and the school. And I could go on about 50 million other things that are wrong with it.
Yeah.
Wow.
The main thing about this is that this charter school, which is being sponsored by this church, is in a district that's one of the highest performing districts in the state, in Cherry Hill. An outstanding district, great teachers, great school.
Is that a rich part of town?
You know what? Actually, it's solidly middle class. It's not like, you know, I mean, look, we have some very, very affluent places here in Jersey. We have, you know, like places like Chatham and Pompton Lakes and whatever else. Cherry Hill is not up in that region, but, you know, it's relatively affluent. But I would say a solidly middle-class district, really doing a good job. And all of a sudden the state comes along, and our acting commissioner, Cerf, comes along and says, you are going to have a charter school, whether you want it or not. Whether your school district, who has elected representatives from your community, wants it or not, and you are going to have to pony up the money to support this school. What Rita is part of is a backlash, which I think it is not an exaggeration to say that they have knocked the governor and knocked the acting commissioner back on their heels. And all of a sudden, there is a group of parents in a community standing up and saying, we're not going to just blindly accept this stuff. And we're going to demand that you follow procedure and that you justify why you want to take our money to start this school. From what I understand, Rita, the response has been very, very low in terms of people from the sending district want to come in to this charter. And at least that's the last that I heard. And so now they're going to open it up to districts all over the state.
As of Monday, when I attended their last Board of Trustees meeting, they told me specifically that there were only 19 kids from Cherry Hill, 15 kids from Voorhees. They couldn't even give me the numbers from Summerdale or Lawnside. Plus, they'll be pulling kids they claim from 14 other school districts.
Yeah. So, you know, there is a perfect case right there. And here's the interesting thing about the story. The pastor who started it has been on stage with Governor Christie. He has these phony town halls where he's got a bunch of people who, like, are his backdrop. He puts them on bleachers behind him. This pastor's been up on the stage with him twice. There are reports that he's been backstage with him, you know, at the last one. Somebody, one of the people in Rita's community, stood up and said to Christie, "You're giving charter schools to your friends." And he's like, what do you mean? Who are you talking about? He says, "You're giving it to this pastor." And Christie said, "I don't even know who that is." The guy was literally right behind him.
I remember that.
That was actually my friend Alan Ehrlich.
Yes, yes, that's right. And
I'm sorry, we have two callers on the line, and I think is 845 New Jersey as well. 845, you're on the air. Who are you?
It's actually in Rockland County, but I actually teach in New Jersey. I teach some high school math, and I've been dealing a lot lately with the new standards and whatnot, and I kind of wanted to talk about the progression of the testing and how it's going to be the next few years for a moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please. What grade do you teach? You teach high school again? I'm sorry.
I teach high school math.
Okay, because the tests are coming for you, my friend.
Oh, I'm very much aware. I've been on top of this. There was a moment there where we had nothing in place for the next 2 years, but just recently I decided to extend the HESPA for 2 years.
Yeah, let's quick clue in people who aren't from Jersey about what's going on. The acting commissioner just came out and said, we're not just going to have one test to pass out of high school. We're going to have tests in mathematics in 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, tests in language arts 9th, 10th, and 11th. And probably test in social studies and in science in all of those grades. So when you take these high school kids, 3 years, 4 standardized tests each year, plus the HESPA, I'm not sure if they're going to get rid of that, then you add on their SATs, their ACTs, their subject tests, all this other stuff, AP tests. These kids are going to be testing constantly. That's all they're going to do in high school. What kind of curriculum are we thinking about coming up here? And the question is for what? What is the possible benefit of doing all this? And at the end of the day, I honestly couldn't tell you what it is because it's exactly what we were talking about at the beginning, D. You want to have this love of learning. How can you have it when these kids are spending so much time filling in bubbles? Anyway, I'm sorry to go on a little bit there, caller, so go ahead.
That's all right. I'm just saying that, you know, they're going to come up for the next 2 years. They decided to extend the HESPA. So the next 2 years are HESPA. Then the next 2 years after that are supposed to be these national exams that we still know absolutely nothing about, except that they're going to try to match up to the standards that have been the new national standards. That's all we really know about them. But there's going to be a 2 year period of time where there is no passing score on those tests that the kids, they technically don't count. The only thing that counts is that it'll be on their transcript, what they get on the test, but they're not going to set a passing score for 2 years. And at the same time, they're trying to bring in this evaluation system where teachers are being judged off these tests, and it just doesn't make sense. You've already talked about how flawed the metric is in trying to judge teachers off these tests, but the teachers have no idea. There's a point of time where they don't count. And, like, right from, you know, as soon as possible, they want to make decisions about teachers off of these tests that no one knows about, we're not ready for. It's just so counterintuitive to everything we're trying to do here.
If that doesn't tell you that the wrong people are in charge, nothing does.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, it's any teacher worth his or her salt hears this stuff and says, you've got to be kidding me. And again, that tells you something about the people who are pushing this stuff. They haven't put in the time in schools. They haven't done the research. They aren't the ones who... Yeah, they aren't the ones who are the practitioners of this. And so that's
like, for example, the new core standards, which are national, they're very rigorous. I'm telling you right now that you're going to see a lot more students not passing these tests because these are much more rigorous standards. Okay?
Yeah. Now,
so everyone's going to have to raise their game. But the thing that blows my mind a little bit about that is they didn't take the time to do maybe a couple of years in a few districts to see how the standards work. We're going national with standards that have never been actually built in curriculums and used in schools. Everyone's switching at once. No one really knows what's going to happen.
Now, why is that? What is the end game of this? Is it to make instruction better?
I feel we're about to play a little bit of a gotcha game here.
Yes.
With scores going down a little bit because we're trying to raise standards and it's more rigorous and you're going to see scores come down a little bit. And, you know, to me it's all about privatization. I mean, it's I don't know how anyone hasn't figured that out yet, but if we're being honest here, I mean, that's what it all comes down to.
That is
I think you
right.
guys... I agree, and we got callers, guys.
Sure.
We only have
no problem.
Hour left. So,
right.
Area code 732,
hey,
you are
you
on the air.
Thank you.
Hi, Jasmine. This is Deborah from East Brunswick with Save Our Schools New Jersey.
Oh, now here's another one of my favorite people. Deb, how are you? It's so good to hear from you.
I'm great way to spend my Sunday evening. Thank you so much. So I want to ask you what I asked Diane Ravitch when she came and spoke at Rutgers a couple weeks ago, which is that I think that all of us who are talking together have a pretty good sense of what the problem is. I agree with you and the previous caller. It's about privatization. It's about defunding public schools to ruin them and then say, look, we ruined them. Private schools are better. And about people making money off of it. But now we're playing defense. And that's a weaker position. And I'm trying to figure out what our offense is. What do we put forth besides reacting to these terrible changes to strengthen and bolster our grassroots efforts to fight back against this and get us back on course?
That's a $64,000 question right there. I just gave away my age, didn't I, with that?
And I was just saying, if you answer it, I don't have $64,000 for you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that would be nice. First thing first, putting me in the same sentence with Diane Ravitch is like putting me in the same sentence with Miles Davis. Diane is the bomb. And God bless this woman for what she is doing. When we look back on this in 20 years, 50 years, whatever, I literally believe we're going to be able to say Diane Ravitch saved American public education.
I agree.
Thank God at least somebody was willing to step in to the fray and fight for us. In terms of what we have to do, Deb, you're absolutely right. We got to start taking the fight to them. There's a couple of things. Again, and I'm really not blowing smoke here, T, when I say this. What we're doing right now has got to be the beginning of that. Having these conversations among ourselves, understanding we're not alone. Go into the SOS march in the summer. You know, all of these sort of organizing things, communicating things, it's important. It does matter. I know it feels like preaching to the choir sometimes, but at the end of the day, if we're not exchanging the ideas with each other, we'll never get a cohesive message that goes out to the public. So that is the first thing, and it's very important. One of my feelings about teachers is that we tend to be people who are very conciliatory. We want to have peace. We want to hear everybody's side. We generally tend to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. And I don't want to take that away, but at the same time, we need to wake up and understand we're in a war. And these people are not backing down. And their goal is to privatize public education. It sounds radical to say that, but all the evidence points in that direction. So we have to be honest about this with ourselves, and we have to be willing to say we're going to get involved in the political realm. and not just deal in sort of abstract ideas, that we're actually going to call out the people who are pushing this stuff that does not make sense. So,
but Jersey,
yeah.
Let me ask you a question, because I agree with everything you're saying, but
yeah.
teachers are afraid. Their jobs are on the line, and speaking up will get you in loads and loads of trouble.
Yep.
So, you know, it's awfully hard to convince, you know, teachers who have families to fight this fight publicly. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
It's such a catch 22. How are we gonna sort this out?
Our unions have to stand up for us is the first thing. I mean, and that's got to be the absolute necessary precondition for moving forward.
Hold on one quick second, yeah. Because we've got a union guy on the air right now. Bronx.
Okay, great.
Bronx, you there?
I am now. How are you guys? It's an honor. Yes, it is.
Yeah,
How are you?
No, the honor is mine, my friend. Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Bronx, you're trying to do this from the inside. Aren't you running for something?
I'm trying to do this from the inside, and you know what? I really thought it was going to be a lot easier than I thought. Okay. I am running for chapter chair in my school, and the election's Tuesday.
Good for you.
And you figure, with what's going on with the UFT, which I think is basically sold us out, especially the Unity Caucus, and our weak, inept chapter leading, figured I would go in like a breeze. Okay? Somebody, you know, I don't know if Norm Scott theorize this, that somebody else, it's a three-person race now. So basically, Norm brought up the point that this might be a stalking horse. Okay? And I've come across with very good points, very good ideas. In fact, I was on with Rich a couple of weeks ago, and I'm waiting to send that archive message out to everybody just on tomorrow night, just before the election. But you know what? I'm at the point where, you know what, you guys don't want to vote for me? Hang yourselves. Because
Oh boy. We gotta be careful with that, my friend. But believe me, I hear your frustration. I really do. I gotta say something about you. You are fearless. And you have been caustic. I mean, very caustic. But I think we've hit the point where there's a place for that. And
well,
the
you
stuff
know what?
That
I don't
you,
give a shit, and I don't give a shit anymore.
It's obvious from reading your blog, you know. But that's not true. I mean, you do and you don't. You're obviously taking this position because you do care about what happens,
that is
evident from what I read about you. And you have very little patience for those who are pushing an agenda that has no basis in reality behind it. And so I give you great credit for that. I really do, Bronx.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I don't give a shit anymore about what people think.
Yeah, exactly the point. The things that you've done, though, with Evan Stone and what's her name? Why do I forget her name now?
Princess Sydney Morris.
Yeah, Sydney Morris. I can understand people not wanting to knock other teachers. I don't want to do it myself. But at the same time, if you're out there pushing something that is against your interests and against the interests of your colleagues, you need to be called out on it. And
you
can argue about
right.
style or whatever else. But at the end of the day, from what I see, and again, I'm not in the thick of the New York City weeds like you are, but from what I see, they are pushing an agenda that is antithetical not just to the best interests of teachers, but to the best interests of students. People need to be called on that. You know,
and
you can't just sit back and allow it to happen. You have to stand up. And if standing up for that means getting involved in your union, and taking a place and demanding that your union stand up and show accountability for other teachers who want to speak out, who want to express themselves, but are living in fear, then that's got to be your job. And I applaud you for doing that. God bless you for doing that.
Thank you. I'm trying. And two things. One, I will, you know, even now, I will protect, go to bat for any teacher.
Yeah.
Okay? Online, in real life, wherever. Okay. And once, and if you, and I'm going to paraphrase a former colleague of mine, said, once you try coming between me and dead white men on green paper, then I'm going to fuck you. And that's what they're going. That's what these people are doing.
Yeah.
You know? And you know what? I just want to read this last sentence from what one of my, not the current chapter chair at my school, but the person who's running. And this last sentence, and she took a dig at me here. In closing, I do not have years of experience, and here's the dig, or any fancy political connections, but I do have a strong work ethic and a belief in the potential of this school. Let's come together. I would be stoked to represent you.
That is beautiful.
You have
okay, no. No, she wrote that against me.
Oh,
who are your fancy? Who are your fancy political connections? Leo Casey?
Hey, you know what? I picked up the phone. I called Leo Casey. We were having a problem at the school that my chapter leader wasn't taking care of. I called Leo. Even though I disagree with Leo, Leo got it done. Okay, where was my chapter leader? Why did I have to pick up the phone to call the VP of the UFT?
Is that what she's suggesting is your political connection? Or
no, I have. I guess. I'm not trying to toot my own horn. I'm not, you know, as you know, there's a, you know, don't have the connections I know somebody else does that I just blocked on Twitter today. And I'm not a pompous ass, but I do know people. Okay, I do know people, and you know what? I'm not afraid to, if I have to help my teachers, my school. I'm not afraid to call these people, and I know people in the media, so I'm not afraid to do this.
Yeah, and you shouldn't be afraid. And the reason that I guess I was confused about where you're coming from is that quote should exactly pertain to teachers. It's not like we're running around in the rarefied era of the Michelle Rees and you know the whomever else, or the Jonah Adelmans of the world. So when she said that, I mean, I agree with everything that she said. I don't know about this particular case, but yeah, it's not about fancy political connections. Having said that,
you're
absolutely right.
She was saying she was dissing me that I know people.
Right, and what I'm saying is
contact.
You should know people, and that's what needs to change. We've got to get to know
people. Not only should I know people, the chapter, the teachers in my school should know these people. They should be on top of what's going on.
Absolutely.
And yet either ignorant or they're hiding their heads in the sand. Because I keep saying this, and I'm going to speak the truth, and I've said this in my school. My school, PS-154, will be shut down within 2 years. We just had our principal replaced on April 30th. They put in a Leadership Academy principal with Bank Street and Teachers College credentials. Okay? I'm already seeing the beginning. What it is, it's going to be a nice, our school is going to become a nice group of happy, responsive to emotion place. Okay, that's
really
all well and good after you come down like Joe Clark with the baseball bat and the bullhorn. Then you can go to that happy, fun time place. Okay, and the shit's going to continuously hit the fan.
Yeah, well, you know what, though? There's no reason that a school, like a parent, can't be both. There's no reason that a parent can't be fun, but also a real disciplinarian in the true sense of the word, that you're teaching your child right from wrong and you're steering your child on the right path. There's no reason a school can't be that either, that a school can't make learning fun, but at the same time, you know, do the best for the kids in terms of getting them on the right path and demanding respect and demanding politeness and character and all the other sorts of things.
Well, it's also demanding that you have high expectations for the students. And you want to know something? Here's a dirty little secret. I'm getting tired of the Whitney Tilson, the little shithead turdbag that he is. Okay, and by the way, I don't want to get off the beam track. I got news on Whitney, and I will probably have it on my blog later tonight. Whitney Tilson has been cavorting and giving money to convicted criminals.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Okay.
Whitney
okay.
Tilson. Well,
okay,
in a shady business.
I do not know of one teacher, and I can only go by my school, I do not know of one teacher who does not have high expectations for their students. Okay, yes, we sometimes get frustrated and we say, you know, that kid's driving me mad, but you know what, where it comes from? It comes from the bullshit, okay, idiotic curriculum that we're given to these students, which doesn't make that they can't learn. It comes from having 33 kids in a fourth grade class, where
you probably
have four or five kids who get overstimulated by being in that large a classroom in such a small space that they become serious behavior problems, and they create learning difficulties for not only themselves but for everybody else in that classroom.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also the fact that since our brains are wired for learning, if we were allowed the freedom, we teachers, to make learning fun, kids, well, let me put it this way. I'm also a summer camp guy. I've directed summer camps, and I, you know, spent a lot of my youth in summer camps. You don't have these kinds of discipline problems in summer camp. Why? Because you're playing constantly. You know what else is going on in summer camp? Learning. Tons and tons of learning. Ask any parent when their little Johnny comes home and spouts all kinds of shit that they wish they weren't spouting that they learned at camp. If you provide kids with opportunities to satiate their pattern-seeking brains, you preclude all this nonsense of having to have masterful classroom management skills. I mean, classroom management is about providing a room full of interesting shit to do. And we're precluded from that because we have to focus on the goddamn test, and that is boring.
You know, you bring up a really good point, too, in terms of summer camp. Because when you look at the totality of a child's learning, yes, school is important. Of course it's important. The teacher, of course it's important. But there are so many other factors that go into the development of that child and what kind of an adult that child is going to be. And things like summer camp, you know, when kids are off for the summer, what are their activities going to be? You know, are they going to get to have high-quality learning experiences? Or, you know, are they going to be parked in front of a TV? Are they going to get the chance after school to go play sports and to have dance class or martial arts or music lessons or whatever else? Or are they going to be in some low-quality child care until the
parents... You're right, but you know what? They're also not going to put 33 kids in Bobby's group, you know? They're going to have... You don't see that in a summer camp.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's actually a really good point, too. You know, for years I taught private piano lessons before I became a K-12 teacher. And the one thing that I came away from for doing it for a long time was that a lot of times I was the only adult beside the parents that this child had for a half an hour where the adult was just solely focused on the child. There were no other distractions. There were no other kids. I gave a half an hour of my time solely to this other kid. And it always surprised me how much that meant to so many children, that an adult was willing to listen to them, was invested in them, that cared about them. But you can only do that in a situation where you don't have all the distractions, where you're not torn apart 33 different ways and whatever. And, you know, that's why Leonie Hamson's work, God bless her, another one, is so important. Getting these class sizes to be manageable so that we can have the time to really spend to get to know the children, to figure out what they're about, and to tailor their learning to toward them, it's just so critically important. And, you know, if there's one thing I could change in the public school system right now, that would be probably at the top of my list. Let's get these class sizes down so we can really get one-on-one with these children and help them with individualized learning.
I want to hang up. I just want to leave it. I'm going to just want to mention two things I want to hang up so I can listen to you guys. One is I went to sleepaway camp for 5 or 6 years. Let me tell you something. There's counselors there who made a bigger impact on my life than any teacher ever had. Hold the teacher, we're going to make the biggest impact. Well, screw you, Whitney. And the other thing, since you're in Jersey, Jasmine, you know what? Let's stop reinventing the wheel. You know what? Chrissy wants to help the kids in New York. Let's look at what they're doing in Upper Saddle River. Okay, it doesn't really take a whole lot of much, to know what to do, and I'll save shitloads of money. Jasmine, it's been great talking to you. It's great meeting
you. Hey, thank you, Brock.
In the future, okay? And, Rich, I have a man crush on you. Okay. which will go
it's mutual.
Wait, are we on the Drew radio show or?
No, it's
Bronx
not.
Bronx and I have a special relationship.
I noticed that on Twitter. You two to get a room more than once.
Yeah,
okay,
we will.
Okay. Hey, listen, if we're ever looking for a third, we'll let you know, Jasmine. Okay.
I appreciate
it. So
thanks,
I want to listen to you. Okay. Bye bye.
Peace out, dude.
Bronx. Oh my goodness.
Guy's insane. I love him, though.
Yeah, we could use a little bit more insanity in the schools, though. I mean, it's a little insanity every now and then is not such a bad thing.
Well, I was one of those teachers who could never, ever be accused of being a school marm. I was the kind of guy that whenever I could, I would pull my kids out of the classroom. We'd bring our work outside or we'd go take a walk because shit was just no fun inside anymore or whatever. And, that's because I think I was very, very confident in my ability. I've worked with kids my whole life. I became a teacher later in life after I had run summer camps and blah, blah, blah. So the management piece just wasn't an issue for me. And when it came to the education piece, the actual, teaching kids something, it was very easy for me to turn my classroom basically into a summer camp group. And I just couldn't understand when I would go and look at other classrooms or watch other teachers, they were sort of authoritative and regimented and, so many systems in place that required everybody to sit down and wait their turn. And, all my systems were self-run. I got sick during my last year as a teacher and I had to take 6 weeks off. It was cancer. I'm fine now. But my substitute constantly, every couple of days, would call me and say, I don't really need to do anything. Your kids seem to know exactly what to do. And that was my proudest moment, that I had set up a classroom where learning just happened because I had interesting things in this corner, centers that could sort of run themselves. The teacher just sort of needed to be aware and keep things in line and maybe redirect a little bit here and there. And that, I think, is the ultimate role of a teacher, this notion that we have all the knowledge and it's going to flow from us into them is complete and pure, utter bullshit, because that's not how learning works. Learning is created by the learner.
And that what you're saying is very, very powerful. And we have to think about this. Again, if you're a teacher out there and you're listening to this, how could you not agree with what you just said? If you buy into that, and we want this to be student empowered, how does having a top-down curriculum assessment, everything being foisted from the top down, how does that help us to get to that place? It doesn't. And this is, again, sort of where we're coming from. If what you're saying is true, and it is true, and that's the purest and the most beautiful form of teaching, we are just headed in the wrong direction. And if we believe in the truth of what you're saying, we have an obligation not just to ourselves, but to our students to stand up and resist this, to stand up and say that life is not all about convergent answers. There are times where we should have convergent answers, but not all the time. And life is not all just about just obedience and you know, doing tricks like a seal to get your fish. That the human condition is such that we have to have a place for creativity and for intrinsic motivation and for self-awareness.
And spontaneity.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly
and,
right.
And that's the thing that school, traditional school, is not very spontaneous. And, you know, over the last, I don't know, probably 40 years, it's slowly become a bit more spontaneous. You know, when we were in school, it was pretty regimented, but teachers were a little bit freer. And then they got freer and freer and freer. We had the small school movements and all that stuff, and kids liked school and things were good. And then NCLB hit, and bam, suddenly everything's a freaking disaster.
Yeah,
it's a very the solutions are so easy. Just let smart people who love kids, let them teach.
You know, when you put it that way, it really is that simple, isn't it?
It
really is that simple. And by the way, that is not against accountability. That, in many ways, what you're suggesting is the ultimate in accountability. And this notion that, you know, having a rich and deep and vibrant curriculum is somehow antithetical toward teachers being able to demonstrate their worth, it's ridiculous, and you know, we need to challenge that. Speaking of which, I do want to say one thing before the hour's out. We have a woman, a teacher in New Jersey, who's running for the assembly, and this is one of the things that I wanted to talk about in terms of what, because Deb called earlier and said, what should we be doing? We got to put our own in positions of power, and if we don't do that, we will never have the juice to affect the change that we need. So there's a woman out here. Her name is Marie Corfield. I'm a huge supporter of hers. She's running for the New Jersey Assembly. If you get a chance, jerseyjazzman.blogspot.com. There's a link to Marie. Take a look, everyone. See what this woman is about. She had the courage to stand up against our governor when our governor was making a lot of political hay by beating up teachers, and we need more people like her, not just in Jersey, but all over the country. We need more of ourselves in positions of power. That's how we're going to affect real change, and we need to get behind those of us who have the courage to do that. So that's why I'm putting in the extra plug here for Marie right now.
Good. I'm glad you did, because I agree with you. We need to back those people that are willing to put it all on the line. And that is one of the things that I think, if teachers at your school, if there's a teacher at your school who has a voice and would like to speak but is afraid because they don't have the backing, all of you teachers at that school need to get together with that teacher that's willing to speak and say that you will back them 100%, because otherwise they're not going to do it, and you're just going to be stuck with what you've got now. We need to start standing up, and the best way you can do that is to tell your loudmouth teacher that you got their back.
That's actually well put. You know, all politics is local, right? And that's where we got to begin. We've got to start with that. So well put. You know, again, God bless the teachers who are willing to stand up. You know, the thing about Bronx, I'm just looking at the chat room and some of the things that he's writing down, too. And, a guy like Bronx is, you know, he's out there, but we need more of that. We need more people who are willing to stand up and to challenge the real challengers of the status quo, not this phony baloney kind of, you know, status quo, which is a big saying out here in Jersey. Yeah, we definitely need more people, and we need to be watching each other's back.
Yeah,
and again,
let's remember the status quo is NCLB and Race to the Top.
Yeah, good.
That's the status quo that needs to change. We got 10 seconds left. So I want to thank you so much, Steve, for coming on. Thank you all the callers that called in. We're going to go off air, but we're going to stay live for as long as Jersey and I want, and we're technically off the air.
Okay.
So now we're just recording, and we can do whatever we want. If it's time for you to go, let me know.
No, it's fine. We can stay on for a little bit longer. I'm having a good time. I barely got to talk about what I thought we were going to talk about, but it was great.
I know.
It's actually really cool to talk to people who've been running the blog, reading the blog. It's one of the things that's been really interesting to me. I keep getting into these situations where people say, "Oh, you're Jersey Jasmine. Oh, yeah, yeah," and it's out of nowhere that I meet these people, and to get the response, for me, it's kind of like, "Oh my God, there's actually somebody out there reading these rants that I come
well,
up
there's,
with."
So. I'll tell you one reason I think, you know, you, like I said in the blurb, and I think I was going to start the show with this, but then we got callers. In the blurb, I mentioned that you're the quickest draw in the edgy blogosphere. And the reason I say that is because it's absolutely freaking true. I mean, a little scandal happens or some reformer says something stupid, and within minutes, you've got a full-length blog post with links and video, and you've ripped them a new one, and it's concise and clear and clean. And I know that I rely on you. If there's something I think I might have missed, which lately I've been kind of busy with this other project, I miss a lot now, I can go to your blog, and I know that anything I care about has been covered by Jersey Jazzman.
Well, first of all, I'm very flattered by that. But, you know, to be honest, you can catch me at the right time when I happen to have the time and I'm free and I can do that. And that's happened, you know, several times. But there are days and days that go by because you know this, when you're a teacher and plus you've got a family, plus you've got whatever else going on in your life, sometimes it's just hard to sit down and respond to something. I'm very flattered again. I appreciate that. I think the one thing you're specifically talking about was this thing between Diane Ravitch and this guy at the DOE, this spokesman who was talking about entrepreneurs in education.
Dude, you did it. You just did it yesterday or today with Alter and everybody on Melissa Harris Perry.
Yeah, okay. I did that one.
That was within hours of that show, you had ripped Jonathan a new one.
Yeah, but you know what? See, this is the thing. I happen to have the time this afternoon. You know, the lawn had already been cut, you know? So it depends on where you have the time. I guess what I'm saying is I appreciate that, but I do get frustrated sometimes when I will look at something and I'll see something and I'll be like, I really wish I could respond to this, but right now I got to take care of this, I got to take care of that, I got to take care of the other thing. That's one of the things that I've talked about on the blog, though, that to kind of take this in a different direction, about the education reformers. These are people who are paid to be monitoring this stuff and to be coming up with message and responding. But when I look at the work output of some of them, I'm just astonished at how little there is. We have a group out here called B4K, which I've obviously written a lot about. These guys are funded by a hedge fund billionaire. The other day, the executive director said that there is no budget, that their founders have told them they're willing to spend whatever it takes to spend. You go onto their website and you see what they're responding to and the message they're putting out. It's infinitesimal. I shouldn't say infinitesimal. It's astonishing how little they're doing in the space in terms of constructing their case.
Is this an anti-reform group, B4K, or is it a reformer
It's a corporate reform group. They're closely aligned with Michelle Rhee's Students First.
Students First, right.
Yeah, you know, which is Students First, Teachers Last. And actually, Students Last, too. But I look at the work output, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, what are these billionaires paying for? And then I realize it's not about debating policy. It's not about having a discussion to try to reach some sort of consensus about what the best thing to do is for kids. This is about power and
propaganda.
Specifically, yeah. But you know what? Even more than that, it's about backroom kind of power. You know, this whole thing with Jonah Adelman in Illinois, where you know, what happened with this Stanford children, and basically, there's no other way to say it, the buying off of Illinois legislators. That isn't about trying to come up with great policies to help with kids. That's about getting your political pieces into place so that you can exercise power however you see fit. That is
the arrogance and the hubris of the non-educators who claim to be doing what's in the best interest of our most underprivileged kids.
Yeah.
They have no firsthand experience with them. They say that teachers are so important, yet they're making all these policy decisions without the input of teachers. They like to tell us that we're important and should be at the table. But then they go ahead and ignore us. And I had a conversation actually with Gideon Stein just the other day, who's one of these reformer guys.
Right.
And he said, no, we want teachers at the table, but we need to be there too. And I responded, and I thought it was brilliant of me. I said, it's great for teachers to be at the table. Here's the thing. Teachers could be the only ones at the table and could produce something that's good for kids. The other scenario where it's just reformers at the table without teachers could never do it.
Yeah. You're spot on. That's exactly right.
So the fact that they invite us and ignore us is the same as just not inviting us at all, except we're the ones with all the knowledge they need that they do not have.
And who put them in charge of deciding who gets invited and doesn't?
Their money.
This is the other thing that makes me kind of nuts here. I shouldn't be invited to your table. That's not your table. That's my table. I'm the guy who goes in every day and teaches kids. I'm the guy who's actually doing the job.
You know who Renee Moore is? Renee Moore tweets a lot. She's a good one. She tweeted not so long ago, "Teachers are the table."
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly right. You know, this notion that somehow we have to be equal partners with people who have no idea what we're doing is absurd. And no other profession would put up with it.
Right.
I'm not saying that the medical profession shouldn't have patient advocates, shouldn't have, you know, insurance company, oh, God help us, but whatever. You know, shouldn't have those people be part of the conversation. Of course they should be part of this conversation. But is anybody going to look at a system for evaluating doctors that wasn't designed by doctors themselves? Is anybody going to look at that seriously? Is anybody going to trust a system to evaluate airplane pilots on their ability to fly planes that wasn't informed primarily by the pilots themselves, by the people who actually do the job? No, of course not. It's ridiculous. And yet, here in Jersey, we had a task force that was put together by Governor Christie, had one currently working teacher on it. It had people who were the headmaster at a private Catholic school was on there. We had people who were lobbyists who are on there, but only one current working teacher. And this report that they produce then winds up becoming the backbone for legislation that is going to determine how teachers are evaluated. No, sorry, no way. You wouldn't dare do that with any other profession. Why should you get away with it in teaching?
So let's take this apart. So
yeah.
We would never consider doing it with doctors. Let me try and figure out why. I think that we would never do it with doctors because there's not one of us who is not a doctor who feels at all comfortable deciding what medical needs we might have. We just don't know. We need to rely on doctors. So consider letting some non-medical person decide on what the standard of care is for a C-section or whatever.
Right.
Doctors have to figure that out. What was the other one you mentioned?
Airplane pilots.
That's pilots.
One of my favorite analogies to use.
Right. Pilots, if the wrong pilots fly on the plane, you're going to die. So clearly,
right.
You know, you don't want anybody but pilots and people that understand aerodynamics. Those are the ones you want figuring out policies about how to fly.
Right.
When it comes to education, everybody who's a parent knows kind of what it's like to teach kids stuff. Everybody
yeah.
that was ever a student knows kind of what it means to be a teacher and to deal with students, kind of. And nobody's going to die in school if the teacher sucks. Nobody's going to get sick, you know, if the teacher sucks. So the public, the zeitgeist, the way the masses look at all these three different professions is two of them are really important because I might die. The other one is easy. And
yeah.
here's the thing that I think is probably not – teachers might not appreciate this. Teaching is easy.
Well, that's okay because we're not live, so we can be honest now.
But
we don't have to worry about
the emotion. No, but they're going to listen and write notes. When I say that teaching is easy, I mean that teaching is easy like cooking is easy if – that happens to be something you're sort of good at, you know, if you know how to throw things together and cook, you know, maybe cooking is easier for you than it is for someone else. Teaching
yeah.
is not rocket science. Teaching does not require years and years of academic training. There's a little bit of brain science, a little bit of psychology that goes into it, but, you know, you can be finished with that in a year or two, really. The stuff that is important for teaching is the personality of the teacher and how they present, how they turn their class into a place that is, you know, conducive to kids learning. So
yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is that the public sort of has a right to assume that because teaching is not rocket science, more people should be able to have a voice because 99% of Americans at least have been through public school. Maybe we'll call it 90%. So just so many people have an understanding and experience with it that they don't with being the back rooms of doctoring and flying airplanes. You know what I'm getting at? Can you please restate what I just said in a way that the human beings could understand it?
I'm not sure I could do that, but let me try. So first of all, in terms of teaching and rocket science and being prepared. So tonight, Mrs. Jazzman marinated a couple bottom rounds for us, and it was my job to put them on the grill. So I got them on the grill, and I've been grilling for years, right? But
right.
I only grill for the family, and I can't tell when the steak is done, and I'm poking it with the instant thermometer. And it's sort of coming up, maybe it's, I don't know, I think, I don't, you know, whatever. So I've got a brother-in-law who is a chef who is phenomenal. I mean, this guy is amazing. And it's like the best food you ever ate in your life.
Right.
And when he cooks, when he makes a steak, he doesn't even think about it twice. Because I've cooked maybe, what, 1,000, couple thousand, I don't know how many steaks in my life. This guy cooks hundreds of steaks a month.
Right.
And that experience is what informs what he's doing. So I understand where you're coming from in terms of people having an idea about teaching, and we're all, especially for parents, we're all at some level teachers. However, there is something to be said about the experience that informs our ability to be experts in this field. I taught with a beautiful teacher years ago back in Florida, and she used to say to the parents when they'd have parent night, she'd say, "You're the expert on your child. We're the experts on third grade," or
right.
whatever it was. And that has to be acknowledged. Now, why isn't that being acknowledged as much as it is? Well, it gets back to the things that we were talking about, you know, at the beginning of this in terms of the pay, the prestige, and whatever else. You know, you can throw in some sexism, too. But there's something else, I think. And let's take the doctors and the pilots as an example. The doctors call themselves doctors. You don't go to see Mr. Jones. You see Dr. Jones. The pilots wear beautiful uniforms with bars on their shoulders and caps, and their shoes are shined, and they walk in with that briefcase, and you don't mess around with them when that plane's in the air. That door is locked, and this is, you know, and he comes on the speaker, and everybody shuts up, and they listen to him.
Right.
These are professions where these people have claimed authority. They have said to themselves and to society at large, we are the experts here, and you will defer to us because we are the experts. And maybe they don't say it in so many words, but that is the general tone. We don't do that at teaching at all. We don't do it at all. T, when's the last time you went into...
Let me ask you a quick question. Do they... You say they demand it, and I think I agree, but isn't it maybe also, or maybe instead, maybe isn't it the fact that we confer that to them?
Yes, and I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a reinforcing kind of cycle there. Another good example, you think about professions where you don't call somebody Mr. or Mrs. or Ms. You know, you call them doctor. You call them reverend. Another one
professor.
Coach. Professor. Another one is coach. You know,
right.
You don't call, it's not Doc Rivers or Mr. Rivers, it's Coach Rivers, right?
Right, right.
You know, so part of that, you're right, part of that is us conferring it. Part of that is then taking that confirmation and running with it. So one thing I was going to say, for example, when's the last time you were in a teacher's room where the degrees were displayed on the wall?
Right, never.
Yeah. Now, when's the last time you were at the dentist's office where the degrees were displayed on the wall? All the time.
In the lobby, right.
Yeah, because that's how you, that's one of the ways that you say, oh, he's Dr. So-and-so. You know, I'm going to defer to him about my abscess or whatever it is.
Right.
Because he's the expert. We need to start claiming that again. And
how?
It's little gestures and it's big gestures. But again, now we get back to the unions. The unions have got to, the unions have been pretty good about being workplace protectors and about negotiators. We need them to step up a little bit more about being professional organizations. And that my union is more synonymous with the AMA. Or the bar.
Right, right.
And,
gotcha.
And that's how we need to structure ourselves. But that's why this fight about teacher evaluation is so important. Again, lawyers regulate themselves, accountants regulate themselves, doctors regulate themselves. Well, teachers have to regulate themselves, and we cannot stand by and let a bunch of other people regulate us because that takes away our professionalism. Our professionalism has got to be at the forefront of what we are doing. And, you know, I don't always agree with my union. We can have arguments about tactics and strategy and whatever. At the end of the day, I do think it is not incompatible to be a force for negotiation and workplace protection, but also to be a force for professionalism. And I think maybe we need to get a little bit more of that professionalism going on right now within our collective organizations. I think that would greatly help our case and what's happening in the profession.
I agree 100%. And I think on that note, which was such a well-spoken note, we should end it.
I don't know about that. Yeah.
Oh, no, it was good, dude. We've been going now for like an hour and a half, so.
I feel like we just started. This is crazy. There's so much to talk about.
Well, but, here's I have an offer. I'm going to make you an offer. You wanna do a semi-regular show with me?
Let's put it this way. I'd love to do it again. I don't know what, in terms of my schedule, things are coming up.
We can play it by ear. But I would love to come back on again.
This was just enormous fun, and honestly, so much more fun than sitting in front of my laptop and banging away at the latest thing that Whitney Tilson or Michelle Rhee or Dr. Steve Perry had to say. And that actually, I thought we were going to get more into that tonight to talk more specifically about some of the things that have been going on. But let's save that for some other time.
Yeah, let's plan on another one or another two, and we'll actually communicate before we go on the air, and we'll pick a couple topics, and we can do a little research or whatever. But I really enjoyed it, too, and I'd love you to come back, and I'd love to do some sort of specific stuff.
Thank you. This was an enormous run, and seriously, and I want to make sure that I say this again so it gets out on the air in the podcast. What you are doing is just enormously important. I'm really glad you're doing it. Please stick with it. We need this. We need more bloggers. We need more people doing this kind of blog talk radio. We need more people as spokesmen in the regular media. We need more people like Marie running for office. We need more people like Bronx trying to get into positions of power in their unions. We need to get engaged. It is no longer enough for us just to be great in our classrooms. We have got to break out of our classrooms in whatever way we're comfortable with and whatever way we can best impact things. And I think you're doing a great job, and I really appreciate this, and definitely, let's talk, and we'll do it again.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, T.
Take care, buddy.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, so that was Jersey Jazzman. Boy, that guy, first of all, he can talk, can't he? I'm not complaining. He's got a lot to say. That was a good time, and like I said, next time we'll go into some specifics, and we'll take callers, and it'll be good. I didn't get to play enough of the Miles Davis tune, and I know that Jersey would appreciate me turning all of you on to this Miles Davis tune. So for the next 11 minutes and 33 seconds, I'm going to play all blues off of Miles Davis' Kinda Blue album, and then I'm going to say goodnight. So here you go, little Miles for you. Thank you. And there you go. All Blues by Miles Davis. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I'll keep you posted. We'll be doing this again. Peace out.